that we will have a transcript, hopefully by this hour tomorrow. And rather than wait for the normal routine of the mail, if you'd like to sign up to have one sent to you, then a special handling to do so before you leave today, we'll get it off to you. Without any further introduction, introduce Lieutenant General Samuel Phillips, the Apollo program director.
Thanks, Julian. Ladies and gentlemen, we appreciate your responding to our press briefing and press conference on relatively short notice. Things are always moving fast in the Apollo program. The events of the last several days have led us to some decisions that we thought it was most important that we relay to and discuss with you today. We have decided to fly the next Saturn V, number 503, with the Apollo Command and Service Module only, and to not carry the Lunar Module on that flight. This decision enables us to move forward in maturing the Apollo Saturn V space system while we work out the problems that are currently delaying the checkout of LEM-3, the Lunar Module that we intend to fly on, that we have intended to fly on 503. I'll discuss the basis of our decision, other things that become involved, then I will answer as many of your questions as I can. As I think all of you who have followed our program closely know, we in the several levels of management of the Apollo program carry on a continuous assessment activity, evaluating continuously the status of the program in its many, many parts, the progress of each of those parts against the individual plans and the integrated program plan, measuring the accomplishments and evaluating the problems that are inherent in any major program. The 503 plan, which we announced here in April, about 4 months ago, shortly after the flight of Saturn V, number 502, Apollo 6, announced a decision to fly 503 as a manned flight, and we established as criteria against which that decision had to stand, that we understand the failures that had occurred in Apollo 6, that we fix and demonstrate beyond question that we had fixed those problems, and that we assure crew safety in the flight of 503. And while proceeding on that course toward a manned flight, we continue to protect an option and our ability to fly 503 unmanned should that eventuality develop. Since then, we have reproduced very accurately and fixed the failure of the J-2 engine, which, as you'll recall, was manifest by a failure of two engines on the second stage and the failure of the J-2 engine on the third stage to ignite for its reburn. That work, in my opinion, was one of the most technically brilliant pieces of detective work in accurately reproducing in ground testing why something failed and devising a fix and demonstrating the adequacy of a fix that I've seen in many, many years. That fix has now been demonstrated by a long series of testing, which was culminated recently by the firing of the number 5 S2 stage in the facilities at Mississippi Test. That firing was on the 9th of August, and that stage, destined for flight on Saturn V, number 5, was the final system demonstration of the adequacy of that fix. The S4B, number 6, destined for the 6th Saturn V, was static fired at Sacramento on the 17th of July and had that fix incorporated. That fix has now been installed in the launch vehicle number 205, which will fly Apollo 7, and in the launch vehicle number 503, which is being made ready at the Cape for the next Saturn V flight. We have also understood and fixed the FOGO problem. There's been a very lengthy and elaborate series of tests and analysis which has involved over 1,000 people that has gone on since April. will be prepared, if anyone is interested in discussing it further, to discuss that in more detail. The culmination of the testing from a system standpoint occurred last week when at Mississippi Test Facility we static fired S1C number 6. That's the sixth Saturn V flight stage for the Saturn V. Now, while some analytical work and some final design certifications remain to be signed off, I'm quite confident that these final certifications will be accomplished. The installation of the fixes in both these areas is on schedule, and in my view, the state of readiness and preparation of the 503 launch vehicle supports our ability to carry out a manned flight on that launch vehicle yet this year. The Apollo Command and Service Module spacecraft that we have intended for that flight is number 103. It was delivered to Cape Kennedy on the 12th of August, and it's a good spacecraft. We have behind us now many weeks of test and checkout experience on 101, which is the first Block 2 manned spacecraft, which was delivered to Cape Kennedy by North American in May. That spacecraft has now proceeded through the test and checkout preparations, which include its test in the vacuum chamber, first unmanned, then with the prime crew, and with the backup crew. That spacecraft is now installed on the launch vehicle, on the pad, and things are proceeding on schedule. And in my opinion, the readiness of that flight for mid-October looks quite good. We expect to be able, on the basis of this experience that I've enumerated the highlights of, to accomplish the pre-launch checkout and to prepare the Apollo Command and Service Module number 103 for flight readiness on Saturn V number 503 for flight yet this year. One technical problem encountered on Apollo 6 remains to have its final sign-off. You'll recall in our April discussion, I indicated what we then were calling an anomaly with the spacecraft limb adapter. We have and showed some pictures which indicated evidences of something coming away from the spacecraft structure in the spacecraft limb adapter area. Since that time, our tests and analytical work has shown us that that failure was related to the FOGO and caused by FOGO. Since that time, we have added some precautions. For example, we've put cork insulation on the outside of the spacecraft limb adapter to reduce the heating that piece of structure encounters during the atmospheric boost. This is an added precaution. We have also provided some ventilation of the interface sheet of the honeycomb structure of the spacecraft limb adapter to ensure against the possibility of entrapped air and its expansion in that honeycomb material. These both are precautions. The fundamental fix has been to remove the FOGO from the launch vehicle and thereby to not subject the spacecraft structure to stresses beyond that for which it was designed. The test and analytical work in this spacecraft area is quite well along, not completely completed. The final validations are awaiting the completion of dynamic testing, which is going on in our dynamic test facilities at the Manned Spacecraft Center, where we are testing dynamic structural characteristics of the upper part of the S-4B stage on up through the entire spacecraft structure. And what we call our short stack static tests, which are well underway now in Wiley Laboratory facilities located at Huntsville. In this area, we have some final design certification reviews to accomplish and the sign-offs of those, but there's every evidence that we're completely on top of this problem, and I'm quite confident that this will not deter us from a manned flight on Saturn V yet this year. LEM-3, which was delivered to Cape Kennedy in June, has been and continues to run behind in its checkout. We are, as of today, approximately 6 weeks behind the checkout and flight preparation schedule that we set forth in June at the time the LEM was delivered. Now, while we have the flight of LEM-1, which flew on Apollo 5 behind us, which demonstrated the fundamental flight safety of the lunar module, and you'll recall that the principal objectives in that flight had to do with the flight safety features involving propulsion, structure, and staging, and flight stability. And that LEM flight adequately proved the fundamental flight safety of the LEM and established the basis for manned rating. The lunar module, which has been in development, test, and manufacturing now for a considerable time, is a good spacecraft, and we have no reason to believe that we have fundamental difficulties. LEM-3 is the first manned LEM to be delivered from the factory to the Cape. It has aboard systems which were not required for nor involved in the flight safety demonstrations that we accomplished on LEM-1. The most notable of these systems, they're principally electronics and RF radiating systems, the principal ones of which that have been causing delays in checkout are the rendezvous radar, the abort guidance system, and an interaction involving spacecraft lighting, which is a critical requirement in these lunar vehicles. The biggest delays that have totally accumulated to date, as about 6 weeks of delay from our June plan, have involved system interactions of an electromagnetic interference nature. They are those which it's not at all uncommon in spacecraft over the years in the first articles to find. In the case of the rendezvous radar, there have been difficulties in getting a reliability of lock on a proper signal and in the problem sense, false lock has been a problem. This has been traced to electrical and electromagnetic interference. We believe that the fix for that has been established, yet there is further system testing in the vehicle at the Cape to assure that that's so. To show you the kinds of relatively mundane problems that can turn out to be significant in the final checkout of a major, complicated new spacecraft, we've had several days of delay attributable to switches. The reason that that even a switch kind of problem can be hard to find and take time to correct is kind of typified by this. I'll let people look at it a little bit later. But the kind of switch that has been giving us trouble is one which is spring-loaded to the center position, and the mechanical features inside the switch are such that when the switch is actuated to the active position, an over-travel of the spring can cause a minute contact with the spring, which is intended to return it to center, for a microsecond or so, and introduce into these digital systems that are a common feature in modern spacecraft, what you can call a glitch. This in turn can cause things to happen that aren't supposed to happen. It took us a while to run that one down because it was such a microscopic duration type of transient. Having found it, it's been necessary to replace panels involving these switches, and this takes time of removing carefully, reworking panels to replace switches with suitable switches that don't have this problem, and to reinstall and to accomplish retest. Another electromagnetic interference kind of problem that we have been working out, and and I believe we're close to having it worked out, has been, a kind of mundane one. But it has involved the lighting system in the LEM. The instrument panel of the lunar module is lighted by what we call electroluminescent technique, which in effect means that the panel, wherever it's not covered, glows, and it's a system which gives a very marked contrast between panel color or instrument and the things that you want to observe, which are lighted in rather extreme light conditions, for example, in bright light. Many years ago, the decision was made that this technique of panel lighting would be operationally important as we got into the variability of light ranges that we expect in our later operations. The control system for this lighting and the voltages involved have turned out to interact with the spacecraft's flight director indicator, what the pilots call the 8-ball, in such a way that by changing the brilliance of the illumination of the panel lighting, the attitude errors are introduced into the flight director indicator system. Now, once this sort of thing is isolated, there are straightforward ways to fix this, but it involves changing, usually involves, and has in this case, changes inside electronic black boxes to isolate parts and components and wires that are the source of the interference, and usually involves, and has in certain of these cases, revising parts of the wiring in the behind the panels, and in certain cases, wiring in the spacecraft to isolate one section of wire from another to eliminate the coupling, which is one of the kinds of problems that's usually behind electro-interference type problems. We set out to achieve a flight readiness of the 503 vehicle with the spacecraft 103 and LEM-3 of this year. We set out in June to achieve flight readiness in November on our working schedule, and progressively have lost time in the LEM checkout, such that as of today, we are about 6 weeks behind that plan. These checkout delays that have accumulated so far clearly delay us into at least January. Being realistic, on the basis of some years of experience now that many of us have had in getting major first items into a complete flight readiness status, we must expect that there will be additional days or weeks of delay beyond that which I have now already described. It's our view in the Apollo program that the probable flight readiness of LEM-3 is perhaps in February, but it's in the February-March time period. Now, we've moved out on two lines. The one line, which we've moved out on some time ago and have more recently augmented, is to aggressively attack the problems that are slowing down the checkout and the flight readiness of this critical spacecraft. Many evidences of success in that line of attack, and I have every reason to believe, including the conviction that we have a good spacecraft, that these system interaction bugs that have been slowing us down will be worked out here in reasonable short time. The other line of approach has been to consider alternatives to the delay to make progress with the Apollo, maturing the Apollo-Saturn system by flying a lesser mission than we had intended, but three or so months earlier than we now expect to be able to fly 503 with LEM-3. We have decided that It is that we can demonstrate the capability of the Apollo Saturn V space system, less the lunar module, that we can achieve many objectives that will mature this complex man-machine system by getting into manned space, into space, with the Saturn V in a manned operation. The new flight plan for the 503 launch vehicle now, we are setting out to prepare to fly 503 with the 103 command and service module and with a substitute for the LEM. We're dropping LEM 3 from that mission and substituting what we call LTA-B, which is a structure to simulate the LEM, which we had built originally in preparation for the possibility of having to fly 503 unmanned. It is a structure which attaches to the LEM attach points in the spacecraft LEM adapter. Its weight is variable by the amount of ballast it's put aboard, and it meets the requirements for this mission to substitute as an inert LEM. We have designated this mission the C prime mission, and I'll have a little bit more to say about what these letters mean to remind you in a moment, and it'll be referred to as Apollo 8. The basic mission plan that we have worked out, and I have a few more days of work left to complete, the basic mission plan is for operations in low Earth orbit. We intend to exercise and demonstrate the ability of our variable azimuth launch requirement, which is a requirement for later missions. As you recall, as the time in a launch window changes, in other words, as we move through a launch window in our later operations, we have to vary the azimuth of launch slightly to account for the time differential as we move through a window. And we want to demonstrate this feature and can do so here. The basic mission plan will go through the Earth orbital checkout of the spacecraft and upper portion of the launch vehicle, which is still attached, in checking out and determining the readiness for the re-light of the S-4B stage. At that point in this basic mission plan, we will separate the spacecraft from the launch vehicle. The launch vehicle will then go through the second burn maneuver of the upper stage and demonstrate translunar injection burn, which is the second burn of the S-4B. The spacecraft will then fly an Earth orbital mission, which is an adaption and in some senses an expansion of the Apollo 7 mission, which is the command and service module Earth orbital mission, Apollo 7. We are, as of today and currently looking at all of the mission plans that we have for the mission sequence, and from that we'll finalize the objectives and the profile and plan for this basic mission plan. We expect to have that accomplished within the next 7 to 10 days. Now, we all realize that Apollo 7, which as I've already indicated, I expect we will be able to fly in about mid-October, is going to tell us a lot about our command and service module. There's no doubt in my mind that the results of the Apollo 7 flight will figure very heavily in selecting the final content of the C prime or Apollo 8 mission that we've newly established. In other words, it may tell us that it's necessary to repeat or to pick up any of the objectives in Apollo 7 if in that operation we fail to accomplish any of the objectives that we have established. Or it may tell us that we have a basis for reaching ahead to accomplish some of the objectives that have been programmed for later missions. Now, in order to provide reasonable flexibility in the final selection of the content of the Apollo 8 mission after we have the Apollo 7 results evaluation available. We are conducting studies, and we are preparing plans covering the range of CSM Saturn V objectives in the planned sequence of missions. I'd like to take just a minute with a couple of U graphs and refresh your memories on the meaning of these letters and the planned sequence of missions. Mission A and Mission B have both been accomplished. These were unmanned operations to demonstrate the launch vehicle and spacecraft. Mission A was a command and service module in the unmanned operation on both the Saturn 1B and the Saturn 5. Mission B, which has been accomplished, was the Apollo 5, demonstration of the fundamental flight safety of the lunar module in unmanned flight, and it was accomplished on the Saturn 1B. Mission C is our letter for such operations as are required with the command and service module in manned flight. Apollo 7 is a Mission C operation. The one that I've just announced and discussed here, the Apollo 8 C prime, is another now command and service module operations mission. Mission D is the one which we had hoped to fly on 503, involves operation of both the command and service module and the lunar module in Earth orbit for demonstrating and developing the capabilities of those vehicles, Saturn V flights in our present mission structures. Mission E has been the letter that we use to describe the mission or missions with which we expect to develop our lunar mission in Earth orbit. It involves apogee of 4,000 miles or so and maneuvers of both the command service module and the lunar module in Earth orbital operation. Mission F is a mission that we have been defining and working on and developing and training for the eventuality of flying the Apollo spacecraft in a mission to the moon, but short of a landing, a lunar orbit mission. And Mission G is the final lunar mission involving a landing. That's what all these letters mean. And the next view graph shows you how our program now for a number of years has been proceeding to build on these building blocks toward the final lunar mission capability. The boxes outlined in solid are the unmanned operations. Those in dotted boxes are the manned operations. At the top of the chart are those that we have or will yet fly on the Saturn 1B. The dotted one marked CSM operations is Apollo 7. Below the dotted line are those we have or intend to fly on the Saturn 5. We have completed the launch vehicle and spacecraft development unmanned flights, and we're proceeding now with preparation for the manned operation. We had been working, as I indicated, to achieve flight readiness of the CMLM operations block, which is the dotted one, and have now introduced an additional manned command service module operations flight in the sequence. We expect to proceed from there to the D or CSM LEM operations mission, and then onward to E and to F or G lunar mission. That's enough on the few graphs. I would like to remind everybody of a talk which Dr. Miller gave on the 1st of May to the Aviation and Speech Writers Association here in Washington. I have a transcript of it here, and it's, I think, an excellently done treatise on the structure of the missions and the logic of that structure, on the structure of the manned lunar landing itself, and on the flexibilities that are involved in the structuring of these missions, some flexibilities of which we've already had to exercise, and it may be necessary for us to exercise further as the mission unfolds, as the missions ahead unfold. Now, to avoid speculation and to set the record straight at the outset, I want to clearly state that the Apollo 8 basic mission involves operations in low Earth orbit. And subject to passing the final certifications that I enumerated earlier, we believe we can fly that mission in December. While we are preparing for that basic mission, we are conducting studies and we are preparing plans covering reasonable alternatives to that basic mission so that after Apollo 7 flies, we can make the best decision as to whether or not to revise the Apollo 8 mission objectives. It may be necessary for us to pick up shortfalls, if there are any, in the Apollo 7 mission. It's necessary for us to have the flexibility after that mission flies to add those objectives or to revise the Apollo 8 mission accordingly. Our plans and studies also encompass those objectives involving deeper penetrations into space, which are technically and operationally feasible by reason of the basic design and the basic purposes of the Saturn V and the Apollo Command and Service Module. The range of technically and operationally feasible objectives and missions include going out a few thousand miles, as we intend to do in the E mission, and there's nothing magic about 4,000 miles. That is the apogee for which we have planned the E-mission. That's unique there. We're looking also at several thousand miles. We're looking at our plans for circumlunar and for lunar orbit. This is the range of penetrations of space for which the Apollo Saturn V is designed. And for that reason, they are technically and operationally feasible. And our plans and studies are looking at those. The Apollo 8 C prime mission is defined as an Earth orbital mission. The final definition of Apollo 8 objectives depends on evaluation of Apollo 7 results. We have rescheduled the D mission to fly on 504, utilizing the North American produced Command and Service Module number 104 and the Grumman produced LEM 3. We have scheduled that mission for the first quarter of 1969. We have reassigned the crews in the following manner. The crews assigned to the D mission remain assigned to that mission. Those are the crews under Jim McDivitt as the commander of the prime crew, and Charles Conrad, the commander of the backup crew, and Ed Mitchell, the commander of the astronaut support team. Those crews remain assigned to the D mission, and our plan is to fly that mission on 504. We have reassigned the crews previously assigned to the E mission to this newly defined C prime Apollo 8 mission. The commander of the prime crew is Frank Borman, commander of the backup crew, Neil Armstrong, and the commander of the support crew, Tom Matty. The D crew, McDivitt and his several crew members, continue their training for the D mission. They will continue, as they have been doing years past, to utilize such time as is available from their training schedule. to enhance their general preparation and state of training for the role that they may possibly play in later operations and the manned lunar landing in particular. For example, they've been flying the lunar landing training vehicle, conducting such operations as their basic training schedule will permit in LEM simulators, in mission evaluation and simulations at the various contractors' plants, and in the LEM and command service module simulators for which they are training on their next assigned or demission. The C prime crews will now alter their training to concentrate on the basic Earth orbital mission, which is fundamentally defined as I've described. They too will, as they have in the past, continue to utilize all the time that's available beyond that required to prepare for their basic mission to enhance their general ability and to prepare, as time will permit, for the role that they too may ultimately play in operations in deeper space or in the ultimate manned lunar landing. I'd like to conclude by saying that as the Apollo program director, I feel that I can speak for the NASA Apollo leadership and the working levels of NASA, industry, and the many governmental and scientific organizations that are involved in Apollo. Together, I feel we carry a heavy responsibility involving the lives of men, the expenditure of large sums of money, and the wisest possible use of time. We are responsible for and dedicated to accomplishing the manned lunar landing as safely, as efficiently, and as soon as prudent and experienced men can do all of the things and make all of the decisions that are required. We do not take lightly any delay or any failure. Neither do we take lightly the successes that the tremendous steps we've taken so far represent. We have carefully considered the many aspects of the current situation and outlook, the most important of which I've discussed with you here today. We've made the decision that we must accept the time that we have lost in getting the lunar module ready for the demission, but that we can offset that loss significantly by flying the command and service module only on Saturn V number 503 in the interval. At this time, we are committing the new mission to achieving the maximum gain consistent with standing flight safety requirements in maturing the Apollo Saturn V space system in Earth orbital operation. I'll try now to answer any of your questions.
Please pull the microphone, if you will, because we've got the system.
General Phillips, you say that Apollo 9 will now be the D mission. Does it follow from that that Apollo E will be 10 and Apollo F will be 11?
That's a possible and probable sequence of missions beyond this. Yes.
All right. And then is it possible still that Apollo 11 might involve a landing on the moon if when they get there everything is right? Or will that definitely be only a lunar orbital mission and they'll come home for sure?
It's possible that could be a lunar landing mission.
What had you planned to do with the lunar that you've now revised?
The question is, what had we planned to do with the lunar module on this flight that we have just revised? We had been preparing a 503 to fly with LEM-3 on what we've called our D mission. In that mission, the Saturn V would place the combined command and service module and lunar module into orbit about the Earth in the low altitude region, 120 to 150 miles. And in that low Earth orbit, we have planned a series of maneuvers involving propulsion of the descent stage of the lunar module, propulsion of the service propulsion system of the command and service module, separation of the two spacecraft with the lunar module, manned and separated from the CSM. Exercises involving re-rendezvous, docking, and a general operation then of evaluating the operation of all of the subsystems and major systems, both in in the vehicle and on the ground. The focal point of that mission, really, I think, is, you could say, rendezvous and dock. The astronauts in the land, in the D mission. Now, that mission stands and will be flown by our present plans on 504. Yes.
If the Apollo 7 goes well and you've got all your low Earth orbital data you need, is there any reason why you couldn't fly Apollo 8 as a circumlunar?
I think it's not possible at this time to project what the decision might be after Apollo 7 flies. As I've indicated here a few minutes ago, we are looking at those elements of the future missions, including lunar orbit, from a technical and operational feasibility standpoint, and preparing plans for penetrations into space beyond low Earth orbit, such that after Apollo 7 flies and the situation can be accurately evaluated at that time, we can decide what objectives to include. While it's a technically and operationally feasible possibility, I'm in no position to speculate on the possibility itself or the probability.
Well, would you try a circumlunar thing without land? I thought that was part of your circumlunar plan, if you have.
The present F mission is in the presently established mission series, the F mission is a lunar orbit mission without a landing.
Well,
it does involve both the command service module and the LEM. To answer, I think, your direct question, it is technically and operationally feasible to fly the Apollo command service module independently of the LEM to whatever distance Earth prudence would indicate the right mission to fly.
Well, you're not going to fly LAM until Apollo 9, is that correct?
We will, that is correct. The LAM will fly first in manned flight on the 504 launch vehicle, according to the present plan that I've enumerated, which will be Apollo 9.
And that might be
certain. That mission is planned and committed to the D mission, which is Earth orbital, Apollo 9.
Is there anything in any of this that would be unlikely to make a lunar landing next year?
And the question is there anything in any of this that makes it unlikely that we will carry out a manned lunar landing next year? The delay in carrying out the D mission puts us into space with the final complete lunar capable spacecraft at a later time than we had planned previously. We believe that by proceeding to mature the Saturn V CSM manned flight system in the interval, that we've offset a significant portion of that loss. We cannot offset it all. We expect that, as we had previously planned, we can still fly Saturn V through 508 next year. I think that the probability of our succeeding with the final lunar landing next year is diminished with, let's say, each week that the mission is delayed. We've taken, I think, aggressive action to offset that loss. And in my view, a lunar landing next year is clearly possible. Clearly possible. 508 is, that is the number of the Alhestis. Well, the question is, what Apollo number would that be? And let me figure it out for you here. My numbers, it comes out Apollo 13. Let me just run through it here quickly. We have designated 503 as Apollo 8, and then if we fly on succeeding Saturn V, 4 will be 9, 5 will be 10, 6 will be 11, 7 will be 12, and 8 will be 13. Maybe we'll do like some hotels. We'll pick another number.
That's even one beyond the G mission you had spoken of earlier.
That's
as lunar landing.
That's
you're saying you can get one more in before the end of the year.
That's a distinct possibility.
What's the crew for Apollo 13?
The crews beyond Apollo 9 have not been selected nor announced.
Houston, please identify yourself and your affiliation before you ask the question. We're open for questions now.
Jim Maloney with the Houston Post. Would you, General Phillips, go through the crew assignments again for me, beginning with the first manned Apollo?
The request is that I go through the crew assignments again, beginning with the first manned Apollo. The crew of Apollo 7, which is the 101 spacecraft on the 205 launch vehicle, which we expect to fly in mid-October. The prime crew commander is Wally Schirra, senior pilot Don Isley, the pilot Walt Cunningham. His backup crew is commanded by Tom Stafford, the senior pilot is John Young, and the pilot is Gene Cernan. The astronaut support team, which is the third crew, is commanded by John Swigert, includes Ron Evans and William Polk. That's Apollo 7. Apollo 8, the newly established 503-103 mission, we have reassigned the crews previously assigned to the E mission, so that the crews now for Apollo 8 are the prime crew commanded by Frank Borman, command pilot Jim Lovell, senior pilot Bill Anders. The backup crew is commanded by Neil Armstrong, the command pilot is Ed Aldrin, and the senior pilot is Fred Pace. The astronaut support team is commanded by Tom Mattingly and includes Gerald Carr and Vance Brand. The crew for Apollo 9, which is scheduled as the D mission on 504, is commanded by Jim McDivitt. The command module pilot is Dave Scott. The lunar module pilot is Russ Swigert. The backup crew is commanded by Charles Conrad and includes Dick Gordon and Alan Dean. The astronaut support team, commanded by Edgar Mitchell, and includes Jack Busma and Al Warden.
DeLong, United Press International. General Phillips, there have been a number of changes reported that you did not cover, particularly dealing with things like the SLA panels. Am I to assume that these will not now be checked out until the Apollo 9 mission, or will you be able to check them out on Apollo 8 even though you don't have a limb on board?
The question is, can we check out certain of the features of the spacecraft limb adapter, which over recent months have been changed? For example, we've changed the ejection mechanism Previously, we hinged the slaw panels outward. We presently, in the future missions, we will eject them. Those features will be included in the 503 mission independently of a live limb, and they will be checked out.
Another question pertaining to the 503-504 switch. Where will the EVA now come? Will it still be with McDivitt's crew? Will McDivitt's crew still do the first EVA of Apollo? General Phillips, will McDivitt's crew do the first EVA in Apollo?
They will.
Okay, one more. What duration do you now plan for the C-prime mission?
Duration, I didn't catch the vehicle, but we plan for Apollo 7 a mission of up to 10 days duration, for Apollo 8 a similar duration.
Houston? No further questions from Houston at this time.
Somebody in communications, tell me whether we will make this or not, or should we try the phone call, please?
trying to get in. We're still asking questions here, KSC, if you can hear us. According to the way you outlined that mission designation, I count six. Getting you through Mission G, General Phillips, that would make Apollo 7 as Mission C, Apollo 8, Mission C prime, Apollo 9, Mission D. We've been discussing that primarily up to this point. That means that Apollo 10 would be Mission E, your lunar mission develop, Apollo 11, your lunar mission orbital, and Apollo 12, Mission G, possible lunar landing. Where did you get 13? I've missed one somewhere in your figures.
Well, what you just enumerated tracks, and then if you'll add the 508 vehicle to fly as Apollo 13, if we wind up using that number. The reason we discussed 508 is because of our plans to fly through 508 before the end of calendar year 1969. Now, I would like to remind us again that our mission sequence includes the planning and preparation for an F or lunar orbit mission, in other words, DEFG, as a possibility, but we have not made a decision, and we have, such a decision is not required today as to whether we would fly after E, a lunar landing mission, or a lunar orbit mission. In other words, that decision hasn't yet been made, so you can postulate on an admittedly optimistic basis the possibility of a lunar landing then on Apollo 11. That is admittedly optimistic, but it's the minimum sequence that I think even an optimist could devise.
Well, then an Apollo 13 with Saturn 508 could possibly be the second G mission flight.
That's entirely possible.
I didn't understand earlier. Will there be any essential difference between the mission in October and the one in December?
There'll be a very important difference, namely that the December mission will fly into space on the Saturn V. In Earth orbit, that's correct. Fundamentally, the Apollo 8 will be in an adaption and expansion of the Apollo 7 insofar as the spacecraft operations in Earth orbit are concerned. We've put it there with the Saturn V, and after the spacecraft has separated, the Saturn V will unmanned then go through the second burn of the S-4B in a translunar injection.
You're putting together the Saturn V, the spacecraft, and the NIN.
That's right.
That's what you're really getting out of it.
That's exactly right.
Right.
Does this new information from JPL about the mass concentrations under the seas on the near side of the moon have any bearing on whether you'll attempt a lunar orbiter mission to check up on your navigation?
No, it does not. To me, that latest information is good news. Our people at the Manned Spacecraft Center under Chris Kraft have been working very closely with JPL and others since this anomalous tracking data was observed on the orbiter flight. There has been concern over errors that were not understood earlier. To me, it's great news that there is now a very sound explanation for the cause of these errors. We are now able to project into our equation those numerical features which will take account of those gravity anomalies in the moon, such that we'll be able to accomplish our required navigation with the accuracy required.
General, why was the decision made to use the E mission crew for Apollo 8? Why not just back it up to the D mission crew?
Question, why was the E mission crew chosen rather than the D mission? We have a heavy investment, as do the crews themselves, in many months of training to carry out the D mission. Given several other crew members that are involved have been training heavily now for many months to carry out that mission. They are in a high state of preparation. The E-mission crews have been preparing for the next mission down the line. They're in a high state of training for being able to move ahead, if you will, and to carry out this Apollo 8 mission.
The E-mission crew has been training in part at this point for some kind of circumlunar mission, are they not? Is this a factor?
Well, they have been training. The E-mission crews have been training for the E-mission, which basically is the command and service module and LEM operations in high Earth orbit. The apogee is some 4,000 miles, and many maneuvers involved in rendezvous, docks, and navigation, and so on and so forth. At the same time, they have been training for later operations, which we all hope will involve landing on the moon, if possible. So they have been training for lunar landing, for lunar orbit, for operations in deep space as their training schedule. Beyond that required to train them up for the basic mission will permit. All of our crews do that.
Does what you had to say about the JPL findings on the MASCONs on the moon have anything to do with your statement that you might make a circumlunar flight any time from D mission on?
It has nothing to do with it. Let me modify that, because I answered that it has nothing to do with it. We have recognized from the time that this tracking data from orbiter was first apparent that there was something that wasn't quite understood about the details of the moon's either geometry or gravity, which were making it difficult to plot precise tracks and to predict precise tracks in lunar operation. We have, in fact, been concerned about this because we've known that we had to understand it and be able to deal with it in some fashion to achieve the navigational accuracy that is required for our operations. These concerns have led various people in our organization to highlight a lunar orbit mission short of a landing or further missions involving spacecraft orbiting the moon to help further to understand that feature of the orbital performance. I feel, and some of our people may argue with me, but I feel that the very logical and plausible scientific explanation for this orbital performance now gives us the basic information with which we can perturb our guidance equation and our navigation equation, and that the arguments which previously had argued heavily for some kind of lunar orbit activity to evaluate this further have been largely offset. So that's the reason I answered as I did, but I think it deserves some further explanation.
A couple more questions.
This is Houston.
General Phillips, to continue in this same general line, there have been some other reasons advanced for the lunar orbit mission. What is your feeling personally about the desirability of the lunar orbit mission and the validity of these other reasons?
In my recollection, it was a year to a year and a half ago, probably close to a year and a half ago, that our studies and discussions of the objectives that we would progressively have to satisfy ourselves that we had a sufficiently mature system for man-lunar landing operations led us to add to our mission sequence for full development the F mission, which is the lunar orbit mission short of a landing. The arguments for having that mission planned and prepared and in the sequence generally are those having to do with evaluating the long-range communications, the long-range navigation, and the long-range thermal situation in these spacecraft, and the effects, if any, of the proximity to the moon on these three principal subsystem areas and possibly others. Those reasons are valid reasons for us to spend the energy that we have in planning and preparing to conduct such a mission. While we have continued to evaluate the relative balance of those needs against other ways to achieve it, we have not yet made the decision as to whether we will require or will not require an F mission in the sequence ahead of the lunar landing. There are still several people in the Apollo program in important positions whose judgments are very important, who believe that that mission will be necessary. There are others who feel there are other ways to satisfy those objectives. Those arguments will be carefully laid out here sometime in the future, and a decision will be made. It has not yet been made, however.
Washington, this is
General Phillips, what is your personal position on this question of the lunar orbit mission?
Now you're getting personal. The question is, what's my personal position on the need for an F mission? I try to keep an open mind and an objective viewpoint on important decision matters that don't require decision until some later time. So I haven't yet made up my mind in any final sense about the need for the F mission. My views in the previous discussions that we have had is that there is sufficiently sound reason that may later emerge as powerfully decisive to warrant the effort to prepare for such a mission. I have, however, been quite hopeful that the course of events would allow us to be able to proceed to a manned lunar landing without an F mission.
In somewhat a different area, General Phillips, late last week, the New York Times carried a story which quoted Dr. Miller as saying that contractors were making too many small engineering changes, and quoted him as saying this is the disease relating to everyone being a program manager and deciding that they best know how to go about or how to schedule deliveries. It also quoted you as saying that the lunar landing next year is within our grasp, but we don't have a hold of it because of the disease Dr. Miller cited. Several questions in this regard. Number one, was this story accurate in that you and Dr. Miller did meet and criticize contractors for making too many engineering changes? Number two, how are contractors making engineering changes if NASA has to approve changes before they can be made? And if you could just enlighten us a little bit on that general area.
Your first question was there such a meeting? The answer is yes. Dr. Miller and I and others on the Apollo team did meet with that contractor, as we periodically meet with each of our major contractors. We did review the status, progress, and problems at that time. Something along the line of the comments that you've made were in fact made by Dr. Miller and myself in summarizing the efforts that we believed are required to get the equipment into shape, technically and time-wise to meet our plans and needs. Your question of how I think your question was, how can a contractor make changes without NASA approval? We have a very well organized and I think well executed change control system, which starts at the level of my office and progressively delegates the change authority down through the levels to the point at which the engineering departments and contractors have the authority and the ability to make small engineering changes and to report them into the system. Changes are, in one sense, the nature of a development program. Yet there comes a time in the development of any major piece of equipment when progressively higher levels of management has to have to take firmer and firmer hands to ensure that only those changes which are absolutely necessary to ensure that equipment will work, will meet its basic requirements, are made. Because it's the nature of a development program, and it's the nature of competent and aggressive engineers to continue to be able to improve the equipment every day, because any day we know how to make it better. Yet there comes a day when it's completely adequate to meet the basic needs for which it was designed. This is always a point of management decision as to when you've reached that point. I feel that aside from correcting the kinds of problems that detract from the ability of equipment to work and meet its needs, that those product improvement changes that we can do without have to be stopped. When the equipment is sufficiently capable and sufficiently reliable to meet its basic needs, then changes have to be essentially stopped. And it's a difficult management area in any program. And the discussion that was held in this instance was to focus on this critical point as we have in times past, and to increase the management attention that's being given to ensure that only the mandatory changes are in fact authorized.
Is this business of small changes or the better being the enemy of the good of such a magnitude that you would characterize it as a disease? And what types of changes are we talking about here?
Well, I don't really want to try to focus on semantics. On occasions past, not only the meeting that you have focused on, I have described among our people and others the fact that, to elaborate on what I said a minute ago, that it is the nature of engineers and development programs to continue to change and to continue to improve. And if it's allowed to proceed, I guess I have used the word disease, and that if it is that, then it is a deterrent to achieving satisfactory results versus time. The change rates are, in fact, higher than we want them to be, and it is necessary by combination of efforts to ensure that only mandatory changes are made and to move rapidly to round up and incorporate the last of the mandatory changes that is necessary. And this is the point that that I've been making here.
Yes. This is the Cape. Can you read? Washington, can you read the Cape now?
Go ahead.
Okay, we have several questions. I am relaying them. Two of the questions concern pad 34 and 37. Bear with us a moment here because we did lose a part of the question, part of the conference. A part of this might have been answered. The two related questions go as follows. From Doug Detterer, If the Chiron mission goes well, what happens to Pad 34 and 37 capability? In related to a 34-37 question is from Jim Strassman of AP. What are the chances now of a dual Saturn 1B launch off of Complex 34 and 37 to accelerate schedule and get experience with the lunar module at a date sooner than 504?
Well, I think if I understood those two questions, your first one was, if Apollo 7 goes well, what happens to 34 and 37? The answer, according to present plans, is that we'll hold complexes 34 and 37 in a state of readiness to call into operation on approximately a six-month notice basis if they were required to conduct a dual launch operation for any reason in the future development of Apollo. The reason for that answer is that the reason that that Saturn 1B and those complexes have been held and will be held in a state of readiness is to back up any substantial difficulties that might develop in Saturn V operation. We do not expect these, and we have therefore recently made the decision to back down on the state of readiness to a six-month call-up basis, which allows significant less effort and substantial savings. We will continue to evaluate that decision and that state of readiness as the coming events and days go by, and we may in the future revise it. If we do, I would expect to revise it to a lesser state of call-up readiness. Beyond that, complexes 34 and 37 will be held in such state of preparation as is determined necessary to be called into operation to support the Apollo applications program at a later time. And the second question was, what do I consider to be, the second question I think was, could we fly LEM 3 or LEM 4 earlier by conducting operations on Complex 34-37 for dual launch? My answer to that is that all things considered, we could not. And I could elaborate if you feel it's necessary.
Question from Mary Bubb. Were the technical problems with the rendezvous radar the primary reasons for delaying preparation of the lunar module? What must be done to eliminate the electromagnetic interference problem? Will this involve shielding?
Go ahead.
Well, electromagnetic interference generally involves shielding or isolation, separation of wires and bundles, changes of components, or shielding or isolation of components and circuits. It has occurred in the past that it requires certain design changes to ensure that interference is eliminated. Other techniques include filters to filter out offending signals. The work that's been done in the rendezvous radar, let me point out something I haven't mentioned before. The rendezvous radar on the LEM is, to my knowledge, the most advanced radar that's been built for flight. It involves a highly sensitive system in order to be able to track accurately at long ranges with fairly low power. And one of the difficulties then is attributable to the extreme sensitivity of the receiver. And the circuit changes that have been made to correct this, to be honest with you, I haven't had a chance to examine in detail. The current reports are that the combination of circuit isolation and filtering promise to fix this. There are system tests underway at the Cape at the present time, which have not yet involved all of the systems to evaluate all of the possible interactions. But there's some optimism at this time that this feature of the EMI has been corrected.
Al Rossiter, UPI. What is the target working date for the Apollo 7 launch?
No.
And the question is, what's the target working date for the Apollo 7 launch? In my comments earlier, I indicated I expected that we would be able to fly that mission in mid-October. Our present working schedule is for launch on the 11th of October, 1968.
We have two final questions, sir, from B.K. Thomas of Aviation Week. First one, are there any changes to the lunar module structure already authorized as a result of dynamic testing?
Go ahead.
Question of whether there are any structural changes to the lunar module structure authorized because of the dynamic testing. Whatever structural changes are required to prepare LEM-3 for flight readiness have already been incorporated. There are no further changes identified as required for LEM-3.
Question, what is the status of incorporating a POGO oscillation indicator in the command module?
The question is, what's the status of incorporation in the command module of a POGO indicator? Since April, our people at the Manned Spacecraft Center have been working with various designs and various devices to indicate or for cockpit indication of POGO. I haven't yet had a chance to review their final work, but I had a preliminary report last week that the Manned Spacecraft Center has reached the conclusion that the best indicator of PILO, the best indicator of POGO, is what, as flyers, we call the seat of our pants, and it now appears that that is the best indicator. I have not, however, had a chance to discuss this with MSC, which I hope to be able to do very soon.
Mary Bubb just asked elaboration, General, on one part of her question. The first part of her question was, were the technical problems with the rendezvous radar the primary reasons for delaying preparation of the lunar module?
No, I don't think I could say that. The problems with the rendezvous radar did appear, as I recall, sometime along in June, and they have been one of the important factors in the delays, but by no means could I say that that was the primary factor.
Thank you, sir. That completes the questions from here.
That there were three apparent problems with the LEM, the rendezvous radar, the abort guidance, and the lighting equipment, the lighting system. And you went into the radar and the lighting system, but not about the abort guidance. What's the problem with that?
Well, I coupled together the abort guidance and switch problem. The problem that I described was introduction of digital transients caused by this switch micro contact that I described, which in turn caused the abort guidance system to introduce signals to thrusters to do things they shouldn't. And that's the one I described.
You haven't directly mentioned, anyway, weight as a problem with the LEM. What is the status of LEM's weight, and is it a problem or is it not?
The weight of the LEM has been and continues to be an area requiring tight management. We feel that we have this, that we and the contractors have it under control, and our projections of performance and weight are satisfactory. It's one that we'll all be keeping a very close track of. At the present time, I feel that it is under control and believe we'll be able to keep it under control.
Any more questions? Thank you very much.